Welcome back. I'm your host, Judy, here with Dr. Rick Kushner. Picking up where we left off, which I'm excited about, we were talking about fair and simple, and 60-40, 50-50.
Exactly. So back in the years when we had a two or three doc partnership, and I was the heavy hitter back in those years, I am no longer that, did my partners enjoy the fact that I was a big producer, hence collector? You bet they did. And ultimately, we reached more equal levels of production collection, and we feel this promotes a healthy competition. And in summary, the big producer is, in fact, once again, covering the biggest share of the overhead.
Do more, make more, pay more.
We believe that to be fair, because ultimately, if that continues, he or she will obtain a bigger share of the equity position as well. And the short-term fairness results from the fact that the big producer, who covers the biggest share of the overhead, also gets a bigger share of the pool. If a doctor happens to collect zero, his or her paycheck is zero, technically.
But how is it with a solo practitioner?
It's the same thing. Only now, with this system, you have someone to cover for you. Vacation and relating it to the partnership, and particularly the doctor's pay system. So if you take 2 to 3 weeks off, next month when collections come around for that 2 to 3 week period, your pay will suffer. But as a solo practitioner, what happened to your pay if you took 2 to 3 weeks off? Well, you probably didn't get to take 2 to 3 weeks off, but if you did, your pay certainly suffered, only it was worse because the overhead had no one else to cover it. In the partnership situation, your partner takes over, and at least the overhead is covered. Now, you don't want to take 2 or 3 weeks off very often because that affects the actual equity value of the partnership.
Partnership sounds good because to me, a 2 or 3 week vacation sounds really good.
Let's talk about bookkeeping with an allocation for doctor's pay distribution. It's a mental nightmare for some until they understand how truly simple it is. Now, we do track production, but really only so we can apply collection to the appropriate doctor. Otherwise, production doesn't mean very much to us. We do track it, but it has nothing to do with doctor's pay or doctor's ultimate equity position in the practice. That is only based on collection to prevent us from overproducing when a patient is treated by two different doctors. Maybe he had to come in for an emergency, and even though Dr. D's his regular primary doctor, Dr. C had to treat him for an emergency or vice versa, and there was a charge. So when a patient is shared like this by two partners, two docs, always pay the earliest unpaid service first, regardless of what that payment was actually intended for. It's a nice rule of thumb. For example, Dr. A does an initial examination, diagnosis, case presentation on a particular patient that includes a crown on a particular tooth that was fractured. We schedule it for later this week. We make a financial arrangement. The patient commits, and it's scheduled for later this week with me. Let's say I'm Dr. A. Between now and this appointment, the tooth flares up, and he needs to come by, and by coincidence, on my partner Dr. B's shift or day. Well, naturally, he or she takes care of it. And let's say it's a root canal on this same tooth and there's insurance involved. We file Dr. B's production for the root canal. The patient keeps her appointment, are you following me? For the crown prep with me, I'm Dr. A again, let's say, and we file for that. And by a coincidence or quirk, which happens all the time, the payment for the crown comes through first. That payment is not applied to me, Dr. A, but to my partner, Dr. B, because he or she performed the earlier service. My computer can tell me, or the insurance, blah, blah, blah. Always explains what payment is due for what service. I understand that. But I'm going to beg you, regardless of all that, fall back to the rule, pay the earliest unpaid service. when there's a family that was treated by different members of the partnership. Happens all the time. With a $142 balance, and mom's going to come up and flip you a check for $50, and you're going to want to go, well, what's this for? Scaling? Checkup? Is this for your root canal? Or what's she going to say? I don't know. I owe you 100 and something. Here's 50. You figure out what to do with it. You all need to have a rule to fall back on. Always pay the earliest unpaid service for it. It'll just save you tons of grief. A patient was treated by Dr. C.N.D. $90 of that 105 was production from C, and 15 was production from D. So those are allocated in the collection columns in those exact amounts. If another patient had a balance of only $6 and some change, and we got overpayment, so we end up with a balance of $32 and some change to the credit, or to the good, or to the positive, that payment of, let's say, $39.20, even though it represents a positive balance, goes to the last unpaid doctor. Same as if it were a negative balance, and Dr. D keeps it, and it becomes part of Dr. D's paycheck as long as we own it. He owns it. And then when that dentistry is performed, of course, it's worked off as a positive balance, or if it's refunded to the patient, ultimately it comes off Dr. D's total in a negative. If another doctor performs a service on this patient, it's done as a paper transfer from Dr. D coming off his total to the doctor who performs the service. So those types of things happen frequently in there. I apologize for that. It's kind of dull, but they're really pretty easily handled.
I can see why fairness and simplicity are so important. It's tough to do either one, let alone both. So how about when partners are added or sold? How does that impact the back end of the operations?
Sure. When we sell a partnership, when we add a partner, whether it's the second, third, or fourth, we do not cut the books. We never stop the bookkeeping system. We keep accounts receivable for each individual doctor, and we keep the practice running. We assume the partnership will come to fruition from the trial period through the partnership itself. And the new partner simply develops an accounts receivable beginning on day one. And as that receivable is collected, he or she begins collecting a percentage of the doctor's profit pool. I mentioned before that we do not sell accounts receivable, and that is technically true, but the new partner has the use of the original senior doctor's accounts receivable to apply towards overhead from day one. That's a big piece of value in this concept for a buying partner. This is a very important concept from the standpoint when you present this system to your attorneys, your accountants, and blah, 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 and you say you're trying to value this partnership at one half of last year's gross collections, making the total value of the practice 100% of last year's gross collections. Your accountant will try to argue with you because he's unwilling to accept a new concept. He'll argue, well, you're going to have to teach him. He'll argue saying practices only sell in full for 60 to 75% of last year's gross collections. That's true. However, it is true for a buyout, sellout, completely different situation. My point is there's tremendous value in the fact that this is a buy-in senior selling partner remains. And the use of the senior selling partner, the use of the senior selling partner's accounts receivable is just one of the reasons we are able to value these partnerships higher than a solo practice, old-fashioned sellout buyout situation.
And the payouts?
The buying doctor gets a paycheck from month one. Already said that. May not be a huge one, depending on how long it takes you to collect accounts receivable, but should not be more than 15 to 25 days. One half to two-thirds of a month on the books. Let's say, as we did before, that the cycle runs from the 15th through the 15th, and Dr. B starts his or her trial period the buying partner starts his or her trial period on the 14th, and the next day we're going to split the doctor's salary pool. And Dr. B, the buying doc, in that one day collects a dollar. And Dr. A collected $99. The ratio we know is 99 to 1, 99% to the senior doc, Dr. A, to 1% for the buying doc, Dr. B. That's the ratio for doctor salary split of the salary pool. However, for that day, it took $50. The overhead for that operation is 50%. It took $50 to run the practice for that day. If Dr. B does not have and take advantage of the use of Dr. A's existing accounts receivable, Dr. B has to slip into his or her pocket to contribute towards that overhead. And that does not happen in this system. Dr. A's existing accounts receivable will cover the overhead of the office. And there's value in that.
Which is why the books have to stay consistent.
Yes, and this was developed pre-computer, of course, as you can imagine. But from day one of the trial period, Dr. B, the buying partner, begins developing an accounts receivable and does develop a collection ratio. Maybe a small ratio initially, but there is one. There's a paycheck from day one, assuming the expenses of the overall office now, including Dr. A, do not exceed the collections of the overall office. It's a very valuable concept. Whereas we tracked the previous month for monthly doctor salary split, if you will, we tracked the previous 12 months for partnership valuation and for buyout, buy-in, and actually death value, God forbid. So not only from a month-to-month paycheck standpoint, but from a partnership value standpoint, an equity position standpoint, there's a constant incentive to produce, collect for all partners, and we like that. Again, our death value is set at 100% as well of that individual doc's collections for the previous 12 months. If an accountant or an attorney states to you that 100% of last year's collections for that personal doctor is a very high death value, it is true. We believe our partnerships are worth that, and the market has proven it. I should say, in new buy-in doctors willing to pay that much. So that is justified in our case, but it is a very high death value. Something closer to 50 to 75% of last year's personal collections might be a bit more of an average death value.
That's a lot of trust in the partnerships.
Correct, Judy. The buy-in split, and relating that to individual equity positions, refers to how existing partners split the buy-in of a succeeding partner. And they, in fact, split the buy-in price of a succeeding partner in the same percentage as the individual's previous 12 months' collections.
Can you explain?
Example, sure, Judy. Doctors A and B are in partnership together in the lean and mean group format, and they desire to sell a partnership to Dr. C. Their house is in order. They're poised for further growth. They're ready to bust open the schedules even further. Doctors A and B have gross collected $600,000 in the previous 12 months. First of all, what is Dr. C's purchase price? Practice meets all the criteria for justifying the formula. So you ought to be saying 200,000, one third. We're going from 2 to 3, one third. Dr. C buys in for 200,000. The question is, how do Doctors A and B split Dr. C's $200,000 buy-in? You should know this now. Doctors A and B produced and collected the previous 600,000 we're using as an example, over the previous 12 months, 600,000 that is, on a 60-40 basis. How then do Doctors A and B split Dr. C's $200,000 purchase price?
On a 60-40 basis?
That's exactly right. And you're not even a dentist. Because in reality, Dr. A, if he or she's the 60% partner, is selling more. All state partnership statutes that we're aware of require that each partner contributes something to the partnership. Well, Dr. C is obviously contributing cash. Doctors A and B are each contributing a portion of their practice because we're all creating equal opportunity for all three. Dr. A is contributing more value than what Dr. B is contributing based on the previous 12 months' collections. And that must be justified in the split of the buy-in in those same percentages. Let's go a little further. Let's say Dr. C joins the practice and they all do really well. The practice gross collects $900,000 the following 12-month period of what let's say Dr. C's is 40%. Now, his or her equity position is not a straight one-third or $300,000. It is his or her 40% of the $900,000 or $360,000 for disability or buyout or, God forbid, death purposes. He or she still owns only one-third of the physical plant. That part never changes. But the wonderful goodwill generated by his or her terrific production collection has appreciated that investment to $360,000 for disability buyout purposes and so forth. If you slow down or cut back, your equity's in jeopardy. One of the main purposes of this system is to liquidate some or all of your equity now while you're young enough to use it and enjoy it. So we recommend that you don't let your equity slip. It affords you the opportunity to go out on top. If you wish to ride out the rest of your career for the next 10 or 15 years in some one operatory slow down system where you can just piddle around clinically and enjoy your craft, that's fine. But I don't recommend you do it in your big high equity value practice.
So, Dr. Kushner, I'm curious. When do buyers become sellers? How often does that happen?
Another 5 to 10 year example, Judy, of a plan to sell partnerships and then sell out completely. Tough to follow me, but you can listen to it again if you need to. As an example, let's assume this is a practice gross collecting $400,000. If you have a $400,000 gross collecting practice, and someone offers you 100% or $400,000 to liquidate it completely, you may take the money. But my point is, it would be extremely difficult, if not impossible, to find someone to give you that in a complete buyout. If someone will, you might consider it. But my point is that those practices traditionally sell for something like more like $250,000. That'd be a pretty good price for a $400,000 gross collecting practices. Now, extrapolate to today's dollars. You could do that without my cheap numbers here. So Dr. A is selling half of this practice to Dr. B. Practice gross collections $400,000. Dr. B pays $200,000. How much of the $200,000 does Dr. A receive? All of it. There's no B or C or D at this point. Dr. A receives the entire $200,000. Where Dr. A receives, 3 years go by. Doctors A and B are in partnership together, and they desire to sell a third partnership to Dr. C. Practice is now gross collecting $700,000. Dr. A is doing 60% of it, Dr. B is doing 40% of it, and that's $700,000 in collection. And they wish to sell to Dr. C. Purchase price, one-third, around $235,000.
There have been a lot of Dr. A's, B's, and C's, and a lot of numbers, but the way you're breaking it all down, I follow. I'm still tracking. Let's keep it going.
Thank you for saying that, because I worry about it, but I've been thinking it for 35, 40, 45 years. And then again, I think it's time we just kind of interject here. Ultimately, success is not about the seller. It's about the buyer. Success is about those people who can make you successful, your patients. You will succeed in reaching your objectives to the extent that your patients feel you exist for them, that you care for nothing so much as them. So try to minimize focusing on yourself, your interests, your practice, your services. The services you're offering, they are important to your patient, but They're not that interested in your services. They're mostly interested in themselves. So that's the real big business of business. In this business, it's your patients. They have only one constant question, and it's a constant you must answer, and that is, what's in it for me, Doc?
And I suppose that's fair when you're paying for a good or especially a service.
Yeah, so to review from previous episodes, we believe in a non-technical, inelaborate case presentation. Excuse me, that's a faux pas. But don't take that out of context. We lay the foundation for all of that in very fine fashion in the pre-exam, initial interview, and the clinical exam talkover technique. Those two steps previous to the diagnosis itself, and we've covered that again in past episodes. If we're having difficulty gaining case acceptance during diagnosis, we won't press it. We'll try without stressing the patient to find the objection, and it's generally the expense barrier, and often it's the fear barrier. We know all of that. As dentists, we all know that.
You said it before in a previous episode. The financial hurdle is a challenging one. People inherently connect dentistry with high costs.
It's almost always the expense barrier. A truly successful case presentation to us is one in which the patient is retained in the practice. And I'm often asked, well, what's your success rate in case presentation? Well, you can look at it from a couple of directions. One is if you believe that the patient stays in your practice, that's a successful one. It's nearly 100%. The other one is how many of your patients accept your treatment plan. Once again, 100%, but maybe not all right now. I rarely find arguments with the recommended treatment plan. They'd always prefer to get it all done. They can't always afford to get it all done, and they don't always get it all done. I'm not surprising a patient with a $9,000 treatment plan. I may very well tell a patient that there's easily $8,000 or $10,000 worth of dentistry to do in there, but we'll take a more practical approach to it. I'm not saying to ignore necessary dentistry or never to recommend ideal treatment. We make patients aware that there's ideal treatment available, but it's not always practical. If I need to present a costly treatment plan, I will have dropped plenty of hints along the way, even as early as the initial interview, but certainly during the clinical exam talkover technique. I will not be shocking patients with huge treatment plans in case presentations. And once again, if that's happening to you, something is seriously wrong, review your lean and mean, this section from previous episodes, and you'll know what to do. They leave the practice and they say you're too expensive. Now, your individual fees for individual services are probably not necessarily more expensive than usual, but your presentation was tailored to yourself. So don't stress the patient. We try to place a priority on keeping the patient over getting the complete case.
We've talked before about dental anxiety, making the patient feel comfortable and heard and part of the conversation. It really goes a long way.
Yeah, I kind of answer it like this. Patients don't deliberately go to inferior dentists. They assume quality. If you're a dentist, you can do the job. So don't try to justify your fee or anything else for that matter by verbally trying to convince your patient that you're a superior dentist. They do business with people they like, and dentistry is no exception, and anxiety works throughout all of those statements.
Absolutely. So true.
Patients are concerned about three things, and again, to repeat, cost, comfort, and convenience. If we ask why they left their previous dentist, it's usually something like, she was too expensive, or he wouldn't take my insurance, or I didn't like their demeanor, or I didn't like the receptionist, which is also a money thing, but they almost never say they left because he did a poor crown or for any other clinical reasons. Not generally, that just does not happen much. They may leave for failure to rectify a clinical problem in what they deem a fair fashion, and that dental anxiety thing umbrellas over everything. Without charging for it, I might mention, but I maintain that's a money issue again, not a technical reason for leaving a dental practice. Patients forgive technical mishaps if they're handled properly. They don't expect you to be perfect. I tell them all the time, we're not perfect, but we're honest.
No one is perfect, and not enough are honest. So personally, I'll take honesty any day.
Solve your patient's three barriers. You'll get lots of new ones. Continue to address their three major concerns: cost, comfort, convenience, in your later relationship with the patient, and you'll keep them, and you won't feel compelled to try to convey to your patient that you're the best dentist in town or better than that next guy or gal. They'll already know it.
Actions. I hear they speak loudly.
Right. So if there's a fractured porcelain, we just repair it or replace it or whatever we need to do. No charge, no need to determine whose fault it is, no questions asked, just apologies.
And down go the three barriers, just like that.
As long as the patient remains a regular patient of ours, we'll take care of any problem like that. Failure to take care of things like this, I'm convinced, is what leads to malpractice suits. We feel these policies that we're describing here loosely keep us out of trouble for most malpractice situations and appearance before peer review boards and all of that kind of stuff. The way to avoid malpractice is patient relations.
I can tell there's more coming up. Unfortunately, we're at time for today's episode. We'll pick up where we left off on our next episode of Lean and Mean, brought to you by Comfort Dental and Dr. Rick Kushner himself. Dr. Kushner, or should I say Dr. A, another insightful session. Thank you as always for sharing your wealth of knowledge with me and with our listeners.
Thank you, Judy.